Welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. The Prime Minister is just back from his big American adventure, and we'll be asking whether the jolly has done him any good. And while the boss was away, his deputy got to play. We ask whether it's now time to take talk about a harm and leadership seriously. And finally, as the chorus goes up for the government to say sorry for the financial disaster, we'll discuss political apologies. Round the table to thrash out all of this are three giants of the Guardian Garden. Sharp-eyed Westminster watcher, political correspondent Allegra Stratton, leading scholar of the Labour tribe, columnist Jackie Ashley, and our resident expert on American democracy, broadcaster and writer Jonathan Friedland. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hi, morning.
Friendships can be shaken, but our friendship is unshakable. Treaties can be broken, but our partnership is unbreakable. And I know that there is no power on earth that can ever drive us apart.
You don't get applause like that back home. That was what Tony Blair said after his own address to Congress in 2003. And yesterday, Gordon Brown found out just what he was talking about when he got his own turn on the Hill. He grinned, he had congressmen asking for his autograph, but Jonathan Friedland, was there anything more to this than show? Was there any real diplomacy at work?
It was actually much less diplomacy in the trip overall than I think some of us were expecting, and maybe even Brown's team were expecting. He only got, well, less than an hour with Barack Obama. That's more than the 11 minutes Neil Kinnock famously got with Ronald Reagan. But it was not quite the big sort of Roosevelt-Churchill summit preparing for the remaking of the financial world, which I think is how Brown would have liked to have presented it. So that, I think, was a disappointment to them. But the speech will have done a diplomatic service of another kind. I mean, he prepared there the political ground for much of what he wants to do in April at the G20, which is to create this global architecture. And by getting a still very conservative, small c conservative Congress to rise to their feet and applaud classic Gordon Brown tropes, I mean, things that a Labour Party conference audience is wholly familiar with, but the idea that we have to, the strong countries have to spend money for the weakest, we should get the poorest children in the developing world into school, that Rwanda is a stain on our conscience, that actually the wealthy's first duty is to the not so wealthy, the powerful to the not so powerless, to the powerless rather, to get a still heavily Republican, okay, Democratic dominated Congress to rise to its feet and applaud, that has prepared the ground, I think. He can say there is a new consensus. A progressive consensus, he may even say, although a phrase he doesn't use often now, that is behind him. So I think he's on a bit of public diplomacy, even if the private diplomacy was probably a bit disappointing for him.
And whatever else, Johnny, you've written that he certainly enjoyed it yesterday.
Oh, my God, he loved it. I mean, it was the culmination of a lifetime of Gordon Brown's work, really. I mean, he's obsessed about America. He has obsessed about it probably since he was a teenager. I wrote that in private conversation, he will mention Bobby Kennedy and Roosevelt more often than he will, Herbert Morrison and Hugh Gaitskill. And so for him, he will cherish that memory. If nothing else happens to him, if he doesn't get reelected, he will, in his retirement, look back on that moment as a crowning moment for him. You could see him sort of basking in it. In fact, he did the basking thing a bit less blatantly than Tony Blair did. He didn't sort of look like the cat that got the cream. But as those of us who sort of watched him over the years know, I think he would have been absolutely thrilled by it.
And he was clearly so comfortable that he even developed, I think there were new hand gestures. What was this? Where he put his hands together. Normally he has his sort of nervousness comes out in familiar hand gestures, and there were some different ones.
Allegra's fashioning her hands together in a sort of
gun
shape.
I've never seen that before.
As Johnny says, Allegra, we know very well that Gordon Brown genuinely loves America. Cape Cod's where he went for his holidays. That's his passion. That's his interest. And when he said that no force on earth is going to tear us apart, like we heard in that clip, I thought of the kind of marriage vows where you say, you know, anyone who might tear man and wife asunder will be struck down, or whatever the words is. I mean, do you think this was just standard stuff? Is this what we have to have when people go and talk to America? Or do you think he was really laying it on much thicker than anyone's done before?
Well, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, I don't know quite the first Brown visit to America as a teenager, but it's certainly 1988 where he was there with people who are now working for Obama. And so the Larry Summers, the Robert Reichs, the Geithner, they're all mates of his. As tearing asunder, lots of biblical language, lots of sort of old-fashioned language. I mean, I haven't heard Brown talk about tearing asunder in domestic politics. So I suppose it was quite dramatic language. Is it what we expect of British prime ministers? He's desperate to get them on board for this G20 agenda, and it was very important to get the Republicans in that room. if not on side, then at least kind of thinking, okay, Obama will kind of allow you to go all the way with this guy. And that's why the speech was so important.
I just wonder, I looked yesterday at the list of people who've been invited to address Congress down the years, and in the 19th century, I think it was pretty much presidents and every so often in a war or something, the Secretary of State. In the last few years, though, we've had Bertie Ahern, King Abdullah of Jordan, and now Gordon Brown. I just wonder, is it fair to ask whether the currency is being devalued?
Well, it might be a bit. Remember, this is a decision.
Brown wouldn't thank you for that.
No, I mean, it's true. John Bruton, you know, I mean, it's not quite the level of before. But I think this is partly Congress flexing its own muscles in a way, saying that foreign policy is not just the province of the White House. We have a voice too. We matter. And they were trying to garner a bit of that. I think the thing that we should remember is, of course, Brown is hugely, even wearily familiar to all of us. In Washington, he was pretty well an unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. And I think what Allegra said is right. There may have been some in the Washington establishment. Let's not kid ourselves that this went out to all of America. They were watching, you know, something else on TV. Mm-hmm.
CNN cut away, didn't they?
to the ads and everything. So this is not a big American moment. But in terms of the Washington establishment, they may have thought that Tony Blair's pro-Americanness was peculiar to him, even at odds with his own Labour Party, who American political types will know oppose the Iraq War. And they may have just been thinking, Gordon Brown, isn't he the guy who was kind of opposed to Blair? Maybe he's some kind of anti-American lefty Labour Party type. And so he did lay it on with the trowel, but in a way he needed to signal to all of them, look, you know, Blair wasn't a one-off. I, too, am deeply pro-American, and lay that as the foundation for everything he's going to ask for and do in the next year or two.
Jackie, I had to do some reaction afterwards, and I was ringing around Labour MPs, and they, about one had seen it.
Yeah, they just weren't interested, and I think in a way this is Gordon Brown's problem, is that as Blair used to do, you can get incredibly excited about how successful your foreign trip is. Meanwhile, back home, everything's falling apart. I think MPs at Westminster this week are far more preoccupied still with Sir Fred the Shred's pension, with whether anyone's going to say sorry, with the growing rift apparently between Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown, with what Harriet Harman's up to that we'll come on to later. And they really weren't very interested by Gordon Brown. And I think, if anything, it's just a quick flash on the news that people were aware of. And I think those images that you saw on the first day of the visit, where he was there with Obama, and I felt he had an almost sort of sad, sort of delighted grin on his face to say, here's my new friend Obama, and he was leaning in towards Obama.
He called him by his first name, and Obama said, really, Mr. Prime Minister.
Yeah, Obama really wasn't prepared to be his best friend. And I think that whole image rather summed it up, that sort of, you know, Brown was the one who's trying so hard to make it look like a great friendship, and Obama wasn't. And I think that's probably the image that people came away with. They didn't listen to the whole speech particularly. I think those that did listen to it, certainly, and I was at Westminster all day yesterday, the reaction I got there was, oh, he's so preachy, it's so churchy, which, you know, frankly plays very well in America, and it was the kind of tone they wanted. But all these sort of platitudes, building for the future and not tearing us asunder and all that, it's past the sick bag, I think, for a lot of people here.
I mean, I wasn't totally sold on the speech itself either. I mean, because he did the poetry, the beacon on the hill that is Washington. He was quoting Kafka, but then he can't help slipping back into fiscal stimulus and anti-protectionist package or whatever. He just has to make it prosaic after a point. But
well,
again,
people here are thinking, you know, I'm losing my job, I'm losing my house. Where's the sort of practical stuff, you know? So it's all very well these great platitudes, but I don't think it particularly helps his position at home.
But isn't there one thing here? It's particularly if, like you say, people are only half paying attention. Then they might not notice that bits of the speech were a bit corny or whatever. They will notice that he was there talking to people at Matter at a time when the world is coming to an end economically, and he's talking to the people that he has to be. And surely that's better than just being...
I think that's right. The images anyway of just the big applause and people
signing autographs.
People know the imagery, the iconography of that building, that room, and the image of powerful people clamouring to him. Let's face it, he doesn't get images like that very often here, and that alone will have been powerful for him. It's true there's a huge disconnect between what works for that audience and what works here. And I felt as if in some ways this was Brown unbound. I mean, this was Brown as he actually would like to be. He would be much more scriptural and more churchy and more sort of poetic. Yeah. And he knows to use language like that in the Westminster contest would make people cringe and be embarrassing. And actually, that's how he would like to speak. I mean, he would love to have the liberty, the freedom to do a kind of Kennedy-esque rhetoric. And in this speech, he had the chance to do that. And I think in a way he was very freed by that. I don't agree with you, Tom, about the prosaic. I mean, I think... even when he was speaking about the quite mundane things, he managed to put them actually quite sort of, effectively and better than he normally does. There wasn't too many kind of neo-endogenous growth theory in there.
But there was
and sort of mundane stuff about home mortgage 100% packages and all that. He avoided that. And in a way, that's where it was comfortable for him. And he can't get away with avoiding the detail when he's here.
But I mean, there was a job to do. And the job was get them on board for the G20. I suppose that was accomplished more by those really wobbly shots in the Oval Office, but less by the speech yesterday, apart from persuading Republicans. But Downing Street people, it's amazing the extent to which they took this trip was his indulgence almost. It was they know it's not going to help him with, as you say, Jackie, with the kind of people are losing their jobs, people are losing their homes. Even though he sees them as intellectually coherent, they see them as very different, and they see him as still having a domestic problem. How important do you think G20? I mean, do you think it's sort of almost too important? It's looming on the horizon, but it will be.
I think G20 is in a way his last chance to kind of pull something back, and he has done it before. You know, we thought he was written off before, and then he came back when the recession first started to bite, and we thought Gordon's going to save the world. And I think, you know, he has a second chance, if you like, to save the world with G20. Yeah. It will depend very much to what extent they raise expectations too high, which I think they're in danger of doing already about the success of this and this new great world regulatory framework. I think the other point to make is I think the Americans tend to see Gordon Brown as useful insofar as he represents, he's the head of Europe and he's pulling Europe together. Now, I'm not so sure, looking at what all the different European countries are up to, that Gordon Brown has absolutely got that bit sewn up. So I think he has a real problem coming up towards G20. Yes, he's, you know, pulled around some of the Americans, but
the 20 is the problem, isn't it?
There's a lot of people. Yeah, there's a lot. And so I think the danger is we're raising all these expectations now for G20, and it maybe won't be quite as good as is being briefed. And then it's, Gordon has let us down again. And also then you have people saying, why is he spending all this time on that when actually back here at home he should be doing stuff to help us?
Well, while he was away, his deputy stepped into his shoes.
Simon Hoggart, parliamentary sketchwriter for The Guardian, reporting from Prime Minister's questions taken this week by Harriet Harman, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, who we know is very keen to become leader and is looking for her chance. Well, it was, in fact, a marvellous opportunity to show what she could do to strut her stuff, but she failed. Now, she was unlucky. She was up against William Hague. Hague is a brilliant performer, a brilliant debater, and she seemed to have no match. She wanted to know what had happened about the government's capital investment scheme. Pointed out that it was due to be in operation early this month, and in fact there was no sign of it being in operation at all. So she then said,
the provisions under that scheme are being finalised, but I would say...
It just sounded so vague. The Tories that have settled down and realised they were in for a very fun time as far as they were concerned. William Hague came back and said it, but this was the government's flagship scheme. Harriet Harman said, this scheme will come into effect, but it sounded like sort of pleading, please help me, don't attack me. You could see the Labour benches behind her looking glummer and more miserable and morose. I started, while I was watching them, drawing up a list of words that describe their appearance: glum, taut, strained, miserable, desperate, gloomy. You could see them thinking, if this person ever became the leader of our party, we'd have to listen to this every single week. Oh dear. Hague was able to dart in her answer.
When Chamberlain lost his party's confidence, Churchill stepped forward. When Eden crossed the Atlantic exhausted, well, Supermac came forward. This could be her moment.
Heavy sarcasm, loud cheers from the Tories, thinking, oh, we'd very much like to have her as the Prime Minister we had to beat. To be fair to Harriet, she did get her own back once. As Vincent Cable was setting her right about how you could make adjustments to Sir Fred Goodwin's pension, or Fred as she called him, rather oddly, I'm sure it was a slip of the tongue, she pointed across at Hague and said, and the Right Honourable Gentleman there got £30,000 for two after-dinner speeches at the Royal Bank of Scotland. Sir Fred Goodwin's old gaff. And actually, to be fair, William Hague went bright red, so he looked like a beetroot on a stick. But it was the only good moment she had, and when she sat down, normally, traditionally, the Prime Minister, at any rate, is applauded and cheered with cries of more, more. There was nothing, just a sort of faint murmur. I'd like to imagine I heard cries of less, less, but it would be just my imagination.
Allegra, sexism's never far from the surface, is it, when male hacks and MPs discuss Harriet Harman? Do you think the fault's less with her than with the testosterone-charged bear that Westminster is?
Yeah, I mean, when Harriet started standing in for Gordon, at that time, it technically should have been Theresa May who stood in for the Tories, and they didn't let her. It was, you know, actively it was going to... And at that time, this was before the Sun interview in which David Cameron anointed William Hague as his deputy leader in all but names. This was before any sort of formalisation of Hague. So there is a sense that, you know, PMQs, you can't let a woman do it. Harriet did it. She did okay. She didn't do brilliantly. And she has the same problem, but it's a problem men have too. She can't, her voice doesn't project. It's quite reedy. So it's sort of, there is a sort of, it does sort of, doesn't carry on the wind. Nick Clegg's voice doesn't carry on the wind. George Osborne's doesn't, to begin with. David Cameron's didn't. So it's not a female thing. She wasn't sort of forceful in that sense. But for instance, William Hague getting 30 grand to do RBS after dinner speeches, she left that till the end, which was quite clever because he couldn't come back. I mean, that's political strategy, and she's good at that.
I thought she was a bit more... She kept it simpler than Gordon Brown does when she was.
I think she was really nervous.
I think she's had a very bad time the last few weeks. She has been absolutely
mauled
a bit
by Downing Street,
yeah. Often over things that are not actually true. And I think she has been shaken by this. I mean,
it's partly
Downing Street decided she'd leaked me a story which she had not, and even though I contacted the journalist concerned and told them it was nowhere near Harriet, no retractions were made. Downing Street continues to insist that she's on a mad leadership bid. I think she has been rattled, and understandably so, by the appalling sexism. I mean, I just find it amazing the minute any woman seems to be rising anywhere near the top, whether it's Jackie Smith or Theresa May or Harriet Harman or Hazel Blears, they're this outpouring of bile, and it's all about their appearance and their voice, and it's nothing to do with actually what they're doing, what they're saying. It's absolutely vile.
We should remember as well that Harriet, has been repeatedly underestimated. I mean, people wrote her off in the deputy leadership contest from the beginning, and we're just talking about whether it was Alan Johnson or perhaps Peter Hayne, and maybe John Crudders could surprise us all. And there she came in, admittedly on the very last round, but she won it. And Westminster,
because Downing Street
helped her along. But Westminster has this habit, and the most famous example, of course, is Margaret Thatcher, who everyone thought, who even the people who voted for her in 1975 thought they were doing it because she had no chance. And she did have a chance, and she won. And I think this round obviously wasn't ideal for her, but I seem to remember when she deputised early on, people were quite pleasantly surprised by how well she did. Yeah. And people thought the contrast with Gordon Brown,
it was
maybe with Brown, but they thought he was so sort of clunky, and she actually landed a few punches. So I think don't underestimate.
People do hate this Westminster Village thing, I think, where, you know, the guy who does perfectly well at Prime Minister's questions, as if he's in the Oxford debating union, William Hague, you know, but people don't like that. William Hague used to always do well at Prime Minister's questions, and look where he got when he was leader of the Conservative Party. So I think the fact she does badly, I think with a lot of people, especially women out there, they think, well, who cares? That's not what's important anyway.
But there is a problem with Harriet Harman that isn't just down to gender, which is that she shouts her mouth off about something when she doesn't know what she's talking about. So we saw that with Fred the Shred, and she said, no, he's not going to get his pension because the court of public opinion won't put up with it. She made some noises against Iraq during the election.
Why was that shouting her mouth off? I mean,
because it's not going to happen. She's in government. I wonder if she's more of an opposition politician, because she's in government, and Fred the Shred probably is going to get his pension, or at least she doesn't know that he's not.
Well, I think there were some dirty dealings going on that weekend, because she made that announcement knowing that something was going to happen, and I think that something then was decided to make her look stupid. I mean, she didn't just say that off the top of her head. She made that announcement knowing that something was afoot to deprive him of his pension. And then Downing Street suddenly decided, let's make a fool of her and change it round.
I mean, the speculation now, correct me if you think I'm wrong, is very much about what happens to Labour once it loses the election. The mood in the PLP is so grim, they're assuming they're going down. And so they're all doing what politicians do when they think they're going down, which is wondering what's going to happen next and who's going to be leader. So the talk about Harriet Harman as a possible leader is... really a post-election thing, and maybe she'd suit that kind of opposition role rather well. What do you think, Johnny?
I think that whole leadership speculation, and Labour, of course, officially would cringe at the very idea that we're already talking about that. But if it depends wholly on the circumstances of the defeat, depends what kind of defeat it is. If it's massive and they're looking essentially for a William Hague, in other words, someone who will serve out one term knowing they have no chance of winning, I think people may turn to her because of the point you're making, which is she's oppositional, and they don't then have to make a judgment about, is this person a prime minister? And so I think I could imagine very plausibly that being the case. And I wonder if, in a way, I don't know enough about her ambitions, but the idea of being the first woman leader of the Labour Party would be enough, almost. I don't know whether she's one of those people who thinks, I must become prime minister, and therefore it's worth waiting for my turn. I can imagine some of the others, the Ed Ballses and others, thinking, I'll let someone else have a turn in 2010, let them be the William Hague sacrificial lamb. But I don't think Harriet Harman would think like that. I think she would think she's doing her duty for the party, and that's quite an epitaph to have, that you on the tombstone, that you were the first woman leader of the Labour Party. I think she wouldn't say
that. I think you're
that.
Right about Harriet. I'm not so sure about the young blokes holding back. I mean, I can't see any of the Eds or the Davids or the Jameses saying, I'll let the others have a go. They're just not wired like
I'm
that.
I'm saying it depends on the circumstances. If it was an absolute wipeout, 1997 type wipeout.
In there. They would come and say, OK, let's start afresh, clean sheet of paper, I'm going to rebuild this party. But they'd want to be there right now. I don't think they'd wait.
You don't think they would?
I think they would be sensible to wait.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
I think if they talked to William Hague, they'd realise it would be very sensible to wait, but they won't. That's just not the way they're wired.
Alistair Darling has called for humility, and the press wants Gordon to say sorry. In his big speech about the financial crisis, however, that was one word that did not pass his lips. Always apologise, always explain. Jackie, is that a good political strategy?
Well, I think it only works if you do it quickly. And I think the problem with most political apologies is they are dragged out of people after days, if not weeks, of the press campaign, of colleagues saying it's really time. And so by the time people do then apologise, it doesn't really seem real. It seems as though they've been made to do it. I'm thinking of Joe Moore after the time of the burying bad news. I'm thinking of Cherie Blair over the Sherrygate flat saga. Yeah. Alistair Darling, in fact, took a very long time. I gather he wanted to say sorry much earlier, but was told by Downing Street he wasn't allowed to. So I think that's the problem. If you apologise quickly, I think that's fine. I think you get away with it then. And I think people move on. People accept if you put your hands up a mistake. But I think when it's dragged out of you and then you apologise, people are not very impressed by that.
That is 100% right. If you think of Gordon Brown himself with the 75p pension rise, 10p tax cut. I mean, it just looked exactly what the Downing Street fear of an apology now is that it will look weak. That's the word they use. And in all those cases, it did look weak. And maybe this is why Brown has an aversion to it, because when he's done an apology, it has looked weak, but for exactly the reason Jackie's saying. Not because it was an apology, but because it had to be extracted like pulling teeth. The exemplar of apology in modern times is, I know people already feel I've ready to canonise him, but Barack Obama's I screwed up was the model apology. Yeah. Now, of course, it's much easier when you're riding very high. But what he did that within the same news cycle as the very event he was apologising for. It was the failed nomination of Tom Daschle as a health secretary. That happened in the morning. Obama made sure he was on the evening news saying, I screwed up, so that everyone actually took it as a net positive. He was admired as being different from other politicians. He took an event which should have been bad for his standing and made it into a positive. It's probably, in fact, definitely too late.
How many times can he do that?
You can't do it too often.
I screwed up was great because, my God, it's the first time in history a politician said I screwed up.
That's right. You can't make a habit of it, because then people think, oh, you know what, he screws up a lot. So that's a problem. But now it is too late. And so you'd have to, I think Brown is going to have to find a way of apologizing.
And the lack of it. There's no news cycle for that.
It's so massive. Yeah. But I think he needs to find a form of words. And the terrible thing is, and we all know this, somebody said this to me this week, we know this from our own relationships and our own lives. You know there's some row going on. The longer you leave it, the bigger the apology you have to do. Mm. If you just did it on the moment, you could get away with a sentence or two.
But this kind of lessons have been learned doesn't work, does it? I thought Ed Miliband earlier in the week tried to do a sort of, we're all learning lessons, but it just didn't work.
Well, that reminds me of my old student flatmate who, when he would complain about the washing up not being done, would say, dishes have been left, right? And you can't go in the passive. You have to say, I didn't do the dishes,
But what do we want them to, I mean, with Brown and the economy, what do we want them to, because he can't say, oh, it's all my fault, because obviously it's not his fault. If he does, then people will say,
it's not all his fault, right?
There are bigger forces at work. And as soon as he does, people will say, right, he's the man who's meaning that your pension's at risk, your job's at risk. It's not like getting the appointment of a health secretary wrong. This is something that's affecting everyone. If he takes what he would call ownership of the problem, then
doesn't say it's all completely his fault, but equally he can't pretend it's nothing to do with him because he was the Chancellor all those years. I think it's a just common sense thing. People are saying, oh, come off it, and you need to come off it and say yes. It is mainly a global problem.
Do you think people need it? You think they do need I'm sorry?
Well, not so much I'm sorry, but yes, when I was the Chancellor, I should, with hindsight, have done more to the... Nothing wrong with that at all,
He needs an account of the past to explain how he's going into the present. And that account of the past, into the future, and that account of the past can include, I agree, it doesn't have to be all about him. It just can include, I think he can say, not some horrible language about systemic things, he can just say all of us, the whole society, and especially those of us who are in charge of running the society, got caught up in this belief of 10 years of unbelievable prosperity. And he can say to the audience, the voters, you did when you remortgaged your home and lived high on credit. We did by not regulating. The Conservatives did because they never once called for regulation. All of us have went for this party for 10 years and now we're paying the price. And I think he can make it our blame rather than just me, but he has to do it.
If you look at previous apologies, it's often the case that there's something rather slippery about them. So Blair, of course, when he finally got round to apologising for fiddling the facts over Iraq, said, we've already apologised, which he hadn't done. And then we've had Ken Livingstone, who apologised for the slave trade, for which I think he probably wasn't responsible, but wouldn't apologise for abusing that Jewish reporter
this,
in that unfortunate way.
There's Brown one. I am expressing a degree of regret that can be equated with an apology.
Another word, get lost.
Stop twisting my arm.
It's very Des Brown, though, isn't it?
And he doesn't have a job anymore.
It's funny, isn't it, when you apologise on behalf of your society? I think then you can be very big and magnanimous.
Yes, because easy enough, because you know your job's not on the line
that's
as a result.
Right, and you can be the big statesman. I'm humble enough to apologise for things people did 200 years ago. It's much harder when it's clearly about you and admitting that your judgment is not perfect. And the argument that's going on, as I understand it, is about this issue of A, weakness, and B, giving ground to the Tories on what they feel is going to be the lead attack line in the next election, which is they're the ones who got us into this mess. How can they be the ones to get us out of it? And so they fear if you give any ground on the first half of that proposition, then you're screwed. I don't think it has to be like that for the reason I've said. I think you can just say all of us really in a mess. And the Tories are extremely vulnerable. You know, as we say often, where is the speech from George Osborne or David Cameron in 2000, 2002, 2004, saying we've got to regulate more, the party's over. There is no speech.
There's almost too much fear of the Conservatives now and giving them an attack line and not enough sort of awareness of the public out there, I think.
Well, I'm sorry, very sorry to say that's it from this edition of Politics Weekly. If you're still crying out for more, you'll find that it's there at guardian.co.uk/politics. And you can also leave your thoughts on today's programme on the Politics blog. Thanks to Jackie Ashley, Jonathan Friedland and Allegra Stratton. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Tom Clark, and until next week, goodbye.